Welcome to Season 6 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $90 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is quite simply a legendary restaurateur. After graduating from Trinity College, he spent some time working on political campaigns before his first experience in the restaurant world in the mid-80s at a Flatiron restaurant called Pesca. After some time working at kitchens in Europe, in 1985, he opened his first restaurant, former HPS Cast Best Idea Union Square Cafe. And over the ensuing decades, he's been the driving force behind some of your favorite restaurants in the city, from Gramercy Tavern to 11 Madison Park. In 2004, he took a step into fast casual, opening the first Shake Shack in Madison Square Park, and has since grown that concept into what is now a $2 billion market cap public company. In his spare time, he's written several highly acclaimed cookbooks and has been at the forefront of thoughtful innovation in the business of food service. He joins us today from his office in the dynamic, and as you'll hear in parts of our conversation, siren-filled New York City. And so without any further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, restaurateur Danny Meyer. Danny, welcome to the pod.
Happy to be here.
Well, thanks for being here. Let's start from the top, Danny. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
St. Louis, Missouri. 50-yard line of the United States of America, whether you're going east to west or north to south.
I love it. How does a kid from St. Louis end up going to Trinity for undergrad?
Well, I think probably the first thing is I didn't want to stay in St. Louis, and not because I don't love St. Louis, but it was actually a tough time in my life. My parents' 25-year marriage was a little bit on the rocks at that point. They ended up divorcing by the time I was a sophomore in college, but the real thing was I wanted to get out of my house, wanted to get out of the city, and probably because so many members of my family had gone to school on the East Coast, that's just what came naturally to me. By the way, I applied to 3 colleges, and I was not accepted at any of the 3. Rejected at 2 and waitlisted at Trinity. So the real reason, to answer your question, I should have just said it's the only one I got into.
Because you got in there. Yeah, fair enough. So you're at Trinity. You get a poli-sci degree. What did you think you wanted to do when you were in college?
Well, I was really, really interested, really from the time I can remember, in current events. You know, my mom and I would watch the news every single night. There was like the 3 things that I loved doing other than homework and practicing the piano were either playing touch football or street hockey or watching Walter Cronkite with my mom. And this was at a time when Watergate and Vietnam and our family had political conversations every night. My dad and his family were Republican. My mom and her family were Democrat. I was the middle kid of a family of 3 in a state that was right in the middle of the country. And truly, the debates and discussions and sometimes arguments that we had every single night at dinner at the table were probably both why I liked politics and I liked food, because food was the thing that brought us all together. It, you know, there's the one thing we could all agree on, whether the chicken was good or not. And but, you know, I started volunteering for political candidates from the time I was 10 years old, handing out leaflets. And I finally had my first and only professional campaign experience, $214 a week back in 1980. And I was living in Chicago right after graduating Trinity with a poli-sci degree. And my first job was working at the public TV station for the public affairs department. And there came a day about, I don't know, 2 months after I started working at WTTW, when I got 2 different job offers. One was to work as the Cook County field coordinator for John Anderson's presidential campaign. And the other was to have a 4:30 in the morning, Sunday morning, public affairs TV show. But I ended up doing the political thing. So I got an amazing experience.
I love it, Danny. What a great answer. Okay, so you've obviously made your living in the restaurant world for decades now. How did you get first involved? What was your first step into the food world?
Well, my first step in the food world was by accident, because it was the night before taking my LSAT, doing the thing that I was, quote unquote, supposed to do, go be a lawyer. That's what you do with a political science degree. And, you know, I hadn't completely given up on maybe being interested in politics. And back in those days, that the way you did that was to be a lawyer. So I had elected law over journalism at that point. And it was literally the night before taking my LSAT. I was out to dinner with my aunt and uncle and grandmother, and everyone's having a great time eating and drinking. And I'm thinking about how I've got to get up at 6 the next morning to take a test for a career I didn't even want. And I have a pretty bad poker face. And my uncle turns to me in the middle of dinner and he said, "What the hell's eating you anyway?" And I said, "Well, I got to take my LSAT tomorrow." And he said, "Well, of course you do. You want to be a lawyer?" And I said, "I don't." And he got furious with me. This is my uncle, Richard Polsky, who's still around. And, you know, he's a great artist. And he asked me the most important question probably I've ever been asked in my life. And he said, "Do you have any idea how long you're going to be dead?" And I said, "No, I hadn't really thought about that. Why?" And he goes, "Well, I don't know either, but I'll tell you one thing right now. You're going to be dead a hell of a lot longer than you're going to be alive. Why in the world would you do something you don't want to do?" And I said, "Because I don't know what else I could do." He said, "All I've ever heard you talk about your entire life is restaurants and food. Why don't you just do that?" And you got to understand that back in the 80s, restaurants were not a cool thing to do with a liberal arts education. They just weren't. It's not something that people did. And it had not dawned on me. But I took the LSAT the next morning. I don't think I did very well, appropriately. I know I never applied to one law school, but what I did do, sometime over that weekend, I asked one of my pals from Trinity if he wanted to join me in opening a restaurant. He and I used to go out to eat in Hartford all the time. I said, "You be the money guy, I'll be the food guy." And he said, "Great, what do we do?" There was an ad for the New York Restaurant School, which I'm sure does not exist today. But I signed up with my pal, Connor, to take Restaurant Management 101. And amazing. It was really cool. You know, I met in that class. Well, first of all, Connor dropped out after 2 classes because his dad found out he was doing this. He said, "No son of mine is going to go into that nasty business." So Connor went on to Dartmouth Business, to Tuck Business School. But meanwhile, I learned a lot, and it was a great experience. And that was kind of like breaking the ice. I'm trying to prove that I'm in New York City right now with some of the sound effects we have going on.
We're keeping it real, Daddy.
This too shall pass. It always does.
Yeah. But before you opened Union Square Cafe, you actually worked in some kitchens for a bit, right?
Well, so that's the thing. My friend Connor felt so bad leaving me in the lurch that he said, "Look, I can't do it with you." He was in a bank training program at U.S. Trust at the time. He said, "I can't do it with you because my dad won't let me. But our bank has exactly one restaurant client," because back then banks ran the other way if they ever heard the word restaurant. And he said, "I'll be glad to introduce you if you want." And that was the owner of an Italian seafood restaurant in the Flatiron District called Pesca. And so he got me an interview. The interview consisted of young Danny walking down the bar with the owner sitting in the middle of the bar. The owner told me to stop when I reached him, looked me up and down from my Wallabies up to my Levi's and my Brooks Brothers shirt. And he said, "You'll do." That was my interview.
Amazing.
And it was a big deal. I got a $250 a week job as an assistant lunch manager. Basically, I was the guy that typed the specials every day, took reservations, took the specials that I typed down the street to the copy shop. But I got to host lunch and I got to meet a lot of people. In fact, to this day, there are people who come up to me and say, "I remember when you were the young guy on the front door at Pesca." And I learned a lot about what I would never do if I owned my own restaurant, but I also learned a lot about what I would do.
So it's 1985. You open Union Square Cafe. You, I believe, are 27 years old. Most 27-year-olds I know are still trying to figure out where the office coffee machine is. Tell us how that all came together.
My dad was in the travel business. He was the first American agent for Relais and Chateau back when it was first Relais de Compagnie, and then Relais de Compagnie connected with Chateau de France. We always had French people living in our home. So I was actually getting an education early on without even knowing it, because there was always good food and wine on the table, and our little dog Ratatouille, you know, had a pretty discerning nose himself.
But, wait, your childhood dog's name was Ratatouille?
Yeah, amazing. I mean, this is back. This is a long time ago, way before that movie. But
it was meant to be, Daddy. I love it.
Yeah, my dad had all these great relationships with people who owned the inns and the restaurants from Relais and Chateau, and so I was able to get two different stages, which is French word for internship, in Bordeaux. And boy, did I learn a lot. I lived in the hotel whenever there was a free attic room in the hotel, or I would live on the chef's couch, go to the market every morning with the chef. And they gave me some really important jobs like chopping shallots and plucking the feathers from birds and opening oysters. And occasionally I got to cook family meal for the staff there, which was a lot of fun. And I just, you know, I learned kitchen French. I learned kitchen Italian when I was doing the same thing in Italy. And I came back to New York in the very, very cold winter. It was 1984 turning into 1985. And I just pounded the pavement trying to figure out where I could open my first restaurant. It didn't have a name, but I had been taking notes, keeping a journal the whole time I was living in France and Italy. And I had really been spending my whole life dreaming of the restaurant that, if only it existed, would be my favorite restaurant. I was drawing pictures anytime I saw a chair I liked or a light fixture I liked, a dish that I liked that I wanted to cook. And lo and behold, after going all over the city, the meatpacking district, keep in mind, this is the very beginning of 1985. Yeah. New York City looks very, very different.
Different time downtown.
I was in the East Village. I was anywhere where I thought I could offer a really, really good value to our diners by signing a lease that was low enough that I'd be able to give the value to our guests as opposed to, you know, just spending all my money on my lease. And obviously I ended up at Union Square, and Union Square was much better known for drugs back then than almost anything else. But I had really gotten it on good faith from the mom of a friend of mine from Trinity College, who was great in the real estate industry. She said, trust me, this is where everyone's moving. All the publishers are moving here from Midtown. The advertising agencies are moving here. Those guys eat out and entertain each other for lunch every single day. And she was so right. We were paying $8 a square foot for the first 2 years of Union Square Cafe. Today, that's a rounding error on an obscenely high number. And we were able to do what we wanted to do.
Well, as somebody who's lived around the corner from there in your old and new location, I will put my own hat in the ring as a favorite of mine. Let me ask you this, and I think listeners could probably pick up on this in terms of the warmth of which you talk about your patrons and your guests. Hospitality and making a patron feel like they're an honored presence there, it's a hallmark of all your businesses. Why was that so important to you?
I like getting hugs and I like giving hugs, and that's what hospitality is. It's reciprocal expression of being on someone else's side. And we haven't really talked a lot about food, but I love food and I love wine. And I can still remember practically every meal I've had in my entire life. I have a taste memory that is kind of crazy. I just remember. And the taste is not only for the food, but often it's for the experience I was having while I was eating the food. But here's the thing. Probably having grown up in St. Louis, where the food was not amazing when I grew up, although I've got to give St. Louis credit for Shake Shack, because that's where I first fell in love with smashed burgers and milkshakes and crinkle-cut fries and, you know, frozen custard and all that kind of stuff. What I really remember about St. Louis restaurants were how good they made you feel, not the food. I moved to New York. The food was a whole lot better than what I'd grown up with in St. Louis, but a lot of places weren't that nice to you. And I knew the difference between how I wanted to feel and how so many restaurants were making me feel.
So let me ask you a question, because I think everybody listening to this would agree with everything you just said. Like, when I eat at Union Square Cafe, every single person I interact with radiates warmth and makes you feel welcome, from, you know, your manager, Dinez, who is amazing, by the way, down to the men and women bussing the tables. But as a leader, how do you ensure that that culture permeates throughout the team? Like, we agree that that's the right answer, but how do you make that work on a, you know, as a busy restaurant like it is?
It all starts with how you hire. And you've got to be really, really intentional about understanding what you're looking for when you hire. Look, this has been, if not the most, certainly one of the most challenging periods for hiring talent that I've ever seen in my entire career, especially post-COVID. And so we, if anything, have redoubled our efforts to focus on the emotional skills that are always present in somebody when we hire. We don't know how to teach someone who's otherwise not friendly or optimistic or curious or has a great work ethic or is empathetic or has integrity or is self-aware. We don't know how to teach any of those emotional skills, but we know how to teach people how to recognize them and how to hire for them. And we know how to teach people how to recognize their absence and not hire those people.
That makes a lot of sense. All right. So you mentioned burgers and shakes. You own and operate some unequivocally world-class restaurants. You've been awarded multiple Michelin stars. In the early 2000s, you opened the first Shake Shack in Madison Square Park. How does a high-end restaurateur come to create one of the best fast casual concepts out there?
Well, I think that instead of looking at them as unnatural bedfellows, I think the way to look at them is obvious bedfellows. So the story is that I had been pretty much the leader of what was called the campaign for the new Madison Square Park. And we were trying to raise, and we succeeded at raising $11 million to restore Madison Square Park to where it was at the turn of the previous century when it was a real heyday. Delmonico's was on the park. The original Madison Square Garden was thriving in this the lot, which is now New York Life Insurance. And it just dawned on me that this park, which was either forgettable at best or dangerous at worst, could be quite beautiful again. It's surrounded by some of New York's best architecture, the MetLife Clock Tower, the Flatiron Building. You can see the Empire State Building right in the distance. And so we raised this money. But the key thing you learn with parks is, and we've seen this with Union Square Park, which has such a great green market, which brings thousands and thousands of people. If you make a park beautiful again, but you don't give people reason to use it, it's going to degrade once again. And we didn't want to see that happen. So for me, the obvious thing is a first step was to turn Madison Square Park into an outdoor sculpture park. And one of the first artists that they brought in was a sculptor from Thailand, whose sculpture was four taxi cabs on stilts with a hot dog cart dressed up to look like a taxi cab. And they needed someone to operate the hot dog cart. So I said, of course, we'll be glad to do it from our 11 Madison Park kitchen. And I wanted to test out my theory on hospitality. I was getting a little bit tired of people saying hospitality is only for really fancy restaurants. I wanted to show that hospitality could actually make a hot dog cart famous. And did it ever. We had lines of 100 people at least waiting for these Chicago-style hot dogs we did. The only reason we did Chicago-style hot dogs is because they've got eight classic toppings. I wanted to see if our team could remember everybody's preferences because you would invariably see the same people day after day. That's the person that likes everything but pickle relish. That's the person that likes everything except mustard. That's, you know, on and on and on. And so this hot dog cart was so successful that the second year, even though we had moved on to a whole new art project, the community said, please bring back our hot dog cart. We took off the taxi cab stuff from the outside of it, brought it back in year two. In year three, we brought it back for a third year. So somehow that year we made $7,500. And then in year four, we had come up with the idea of turning this hot dog cart into a permanent kiosk. And I had just read this amazing book, which I highly recommend, called The Cathedral Within by Billy Shore, who's the founder of Share Our Strength, an organization that has been fighting childhood hunger, No Kid Hungry, for many, many years. But Billy's notion in The Cathedral Within was this notion of creating community wealth as an alternative to either philanthropy or government support of programs. It's basically an early version of conscious capitalism, which is to say capitalism works, and there's nothing about capitalism that says you can't be doing things for the public good. But what if you were to do them in a way that actually created great community wealth? So I got the idea with this kiosk that I named Shake Shack that we would gift the kiosk to Madison Square Park. We gifted this structure to Madison Square Park. Madison Square Park would become the landlord. We would own the business. I had absolutely no idea that this was going to go on and be a successful business, never mind a scaled business, never mind a public company, never mind an international company. And boy, was that a good idea because, and a very fortunate, lucky idea. To this day, Madison Square Park's rent collection from that one Shake Shack approaches $1 million a year. That goes right back into the park. Amazing. And we got a nice business out of the deal. And I wish I could do it again because it's a great business model.
It's a great win-win. Well, let me ask you this. From those beginnings, you know, you now have this massive business in Shake Shack. What are the different challenges of running a multi-location fast casual business versus running a collection of fine dining restaurants?
Oh, there's a myriad of differences. Shake Shack is led by a magnificent CEO named Randy Garuti, who came to me as a 22-year-old. He was a GM for us at Tabla, and then he was our GM at the original Union Square Cafe. And when we started creating Shake Shack, and we literally created the Shack Burger and all this stuff out of the private dining room kitchen of 11 Madison Park, Randy said, this is what I want to do. He was like, I've had enough of the fine dining stuff. This is what I want to do. You know, Randy knows our culture inside and out and has just found an amazing way to scale it. I can go to any Shake Shack anywhere in the world practically and feel the very type of hospitality culture that we've talked about and lived with all of our restaurants. So language is really the way you scale culture.
Yeah. What do you mean by that, Danny? That's interesting.
Yeah. Language is like the mortar between the bricks of culture. It's the thing that holds it together. What language does is it does two things. It creates a shortcut where everybody who's part of that culture understands very quickly what you're talking about. When I wrote Setting the Table, I actually wrote it for our own team. Turned out to work for a lot of other teams in a lot of other business sectors, not just restaurants. But it created a language so that we have a shortcut way of saying almost everything. If I say center the salt shaker to the average person on the street, they're going to look at me like I'm from Mars. If I say it to someone in my company, they're going to know that means do the thing the right way. If I were to say something like write a great next chapter, everyone in our company knows what that means. It means we made a mistake. Now make it better. And make it so much better that you end up in a better spot than if you hadn't made the mistake in the first place. And you can do this, especially with a big company. You got to teach the language, but you can absolutely do that. Is it also makes people feel like they belong, because I think the biggest longing human beings have is to belong. And something that I think is the same between Shake Shack and say Gramercy Tavern or Chisiamo or Union Square Cafe or Maialino, whatever, is you've got to find a way to make sure that the people who get the promotions are not just the people who were the best at the job they did, but maybe even more importantly, were the best at advancing the culture. I know in my industry for years, you'll sometimes see the best line cook becomes a sous chef. Well, they may be absolutely horrible at motivating and leading and nurturing people.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly well said, Danny. And in hearing you talk about this, I'm not at all surprised to have experienced the consistency of the culture at your institutions. Like, it's clear it permeates everything you do. I love it. All right, Danny, so now before we move to the last part of the podcast, I want to bring you through a speed round. I'm going to give you some simple questions. You give me simple answers. First thought, best thought. Favorite New York restaurant that you're not personally involved in?
Probably Sparks Steakhouse.
For the record, my favorite steak on the Isle of Manhattan. I love that place.
Damn good wine list, too.
Yeah, still got it. Favorite cookbook in your home kitchen?
Patricia Wells' Bistro Cooking. Every recipe in that book is great and doable.
Preferred cocktail on a summer Friday after a long week?
That's simple. The Mortoni, which is a cocktail I named after my late father, Morton Meyer. He would come home from work, and his favorite cocktail back in the 1970s was a Negroni, which, of course, didn't come into vogue until much later. But I never liked gin. I never liked vermouth. So I said, I got to come up with some way to have a drink that reminds me of him, but that I like. And so it's real simple drink, and it's amazing. It's 1 ounce of Campari, 1 ounce of vodka, a squeeze of orange, lemon, and lime. Shake it all up over ice. Pour that over the rocks, and then top it with your choice of 1 ounce of either tonic water or 1 ounce of club soda.
Amazing.
So it's 1 ounce, 1 ounce, 1 ounce. It's the Mortoni I promise it is the most refreshing drink you've ever had.
Great answer. All right. Favorite thing to grill on summer weekends?
My favorite thing to grill is baby back ribs. Unfortunately, I'm the only one in my family that loves them. And so I'm going to have to go with Pat LaFreda porterhouse steaks.
A little more crowd pleasing.
Everyone loves them.
Favorite food city that isn't New York?
It really depends on what kind of mood I'm in. Are we in the United States?
Wherever you want to go, Danny.
Rome.
That's a great answer. What's the next big food item trend? Like when suddenly kale was everywhere, what do you think is the next big thing?
I'm glad that I cannot even think about answering the question because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the next new thing is the thing that grew last night that I can get in the green market. And I don't think about the next trend as much as what's freshest today.
Fair enough. What's your go-to order at Union Square Cafe?
Gruyere salad, bib lettuce with Gruyere.
It's unbelievable.
Followed by a half portion of whatever pasta Chef Lena Ciardullo is making because her pastas are out of this world. I had one recently, which is her take on pasta alla Nerano, which you get down on the Amalfi Coast, so zucchini and walnuts is really good. And then probably her pork chop, which is absolutely incredible. Her pork chop is one of the best I've ever had in my life.
I think it's amazing. I would have gone for the chicken scarpariello, but that's just me. But the rest of that I agree with completely.
I'd be happy if that's what I had to have as well.
What's your guilty pleasure unhealthy snack?
I wouldn't call it a snack because I eat it anytime I can, but almost always for dinner, sausage and mushroom pizza.
There you go.
For me, that's my favorite thing. I just love it.
All right, last one. What's the best place to get ice cream in Manhattan and why is it Cafe Panna?
Yeah, it is the best ice cream in New York. My daughter, Hallie, who I'm so proud of, took her English literature degree from Yale and decided this is what she wanted to do. She's been eating ice cream her whole life. She's a remarkably good cook.
I mean, in fairness, she learned it from watching you, Danny. I mean.
Well, the only thing I try to teach her was a good cook always cleans up while she's cooking. But she, you know, when she was a kid, the same way that I would, you know, like to go out and play football and all the kinds of stuff I did, she just wanted to read cookbooks and cook. And she never actually cooked from a recipe, but she read them all and she learned technique by doing that. And she's really doing some great stuff at Cafe Panna. I'm so proud of her.
I mean, my only complaint, because I live right around the corner, you can't get in there. The line's out the door all the time. It's,
buy a bunch of pints and take them home. And
exactly.
Don't need to worry about the line.
Well, Danny, thank you for the speed round. Exciting stuff. And here's to your many exciting new ventures. Let's move then to the last segment of the podcast. It's something we call Best Ideas, where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently. Danny, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea this week?
My best idea this week is my best idea every week. And you've actually already heard me say it on this podcast when we heard the siren, which is this too shall pass. I really, really believe that, you know, I've been in business now long enough, starting in 1985, to have seen every single thing imaginable in terms of economic cycles, a pandemic, 9/11, Hurricane Sandy. And each time these things happen, you kind of go like, how are we going to get out of this? It's kind of a version of when you're in the absolute worst traffic trying to get into the Holland Tunnel, trying to get home from New Jersey on a Sunday night, and you just want to be in bed and nothing's moving. There's 8 lanes all blocked up by a car accident that involved 3 cars. And you go, when is this ever going to end? And it does. It ends. It will break up. This too shall pass. That's what keeps me calm.
I think that's great advice for anybody. All right. So then my best idea, as listeners know, I always like to be inspired by the guest of the week. Danny is, of course, a restaurateur through and through. And so in that vein, I wanted to recommend a current favorite TV show of mine. Now, I will say I'm interested to hear at the end of this whether he'd watch something like this or if it's like me with a show like Billions or things like that, where it's a little too close to a world, it can be tricky to enjoy. But in any case, my best idea this week is the fantastic new TV show on Hulu called The Bear. Now, The Bear is a story of a young hot chef, James Beard Award winner. He works at French Laundry in NoMa. His brother passes away, and in his will, he gives to our young chef his struggling neighborhood Chicago beef joint. The show then tells the story of this high-flying chef coming home to save his late brother's restaurant. But it's really about intense relationships with some interesting reveals of twists throughout the first season that will keep you guessing. It is, full disclosure, a nail-biting watch. Like, the way it depicts the frenetic nature of kitchen life has drawn praise from better chefs than me. And one of the things I love about it is the episodes are 30 minutes long. Like, it almost would be too much to watch an hour of it. So in honor of a restaurateur who knows a bit about being at high-end restaurants and then going for a more casual offering, let me recommend The Bear on Hulu as my best idea this week. Danny, have you seen it, or is it a little too close to home?
I've definitely seen it. I just finished episode 3 with my wife last night, and I'm enjoying it, and I think they've done a fantastic job, and I can't wait to keep watching it.
Yeah,
I do want to also recommend another series very quickly, which is Swedish, called The Restaurant.
Okay.
And it's absolutely amazing. It's got 3 seasons, and it's very, very different than this one. You can watch a whole hour and not get too uptight. But it's about a family in Sweden. It takes you all the way from World War II up through the present. So you're seeing history of Scandinavia as well, and breathtaking food. But it's not as deeply about the restaurant business as it is this family and all the relationships that happen. So those are my 2 favorite.
Called The Restaurant?
It's called The Restaurant.
Yeah, I love it. Great recommendation. Danny, with that, it's time to say goodbye for the week. We so appreciate you coming on. We appreciate you taking the time, and good luck with all your ventures going forward.
Thank you, Colbert.
Thanks again to our guest, Danny Meyer. Check out our show notes to learn more about Danny and his restaurant group, Union Square Hospitality. You'll also find a link to my best idea, the Hulu TV show, The Bear, and to Danny's impromptu second recommendation, Swedish TV show, The Restaurant. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen.